originally snuck into her foster parents' room looking for something to steal from Frances, who gave her the weakest welcome, she spotted Jen Laurie's bedside dumbbells and gave lifting a shot. Her own parents, locked up for robbing a family-owned movie theater, inspired her kleptomaniac urges, but Amy discovered working on herself made her feel more powerful than stealing from others. Amy already misses going on runs with Rufus while he rides his bike, and she'll always think back to the time when she taught him to do a proper push-up, and she has no idea what comes next.
Mateo, 7:22 a.m. I keep running down the block, far away from Rufus. I'm last friendless, but maybe dying alone is an okay end day for someone who lived his life pretty alone. I don't know what Rufus was involved in that led to his friends being arrested. Maybe he was hoping to use me as some alibi, but now I'm gone. I stop to catch my breath. I sit on the stoop of this daycare and press my palm against my aching ribcage. Maybe I should go back home and play some video games. Write more letters. I even wish I was still in high school and attending one of Mr. Kalampukas's classes because he always made me feel seen. Though sharing a chemistry lab with kids who were always texting while mixing chemicals was terrifying, even last fall when it wasn't my end day. Mateo! Rufus is riding his bike down the block, his helmet swinging from the handlebars. I get up and keep moving, but it's no use. Rufus pulls up next to me, swinging his left leg behind the seat, and then hops off his bike. The bike falls to the ground as Rufus catches me by my arm. He looks me in the eyes, and when I realize he isn't pissed, but instead frightened, I'm absolutely certain he isn't how I end. "Are you crazy?" Rufus asks. "We're not supposed to split up." "And you're not supposed to be a total stranger," I say. We've been together for several hours now. I sat down with him at his favorite diner, where he told me who he wanted to be if he had years ahead of him. "But you're apparently running from the cops, and you never mentioned that once." "I don't know if the cops are actually looking for me," Rufus says. "They gotta know I'm a Decker, and it's not like I robbed a bank, so they're not gonna send the entire force looking for me." "What did you do?" Rufus lets go of me and looks around. "Let's go somewhere and talk. I'll give you the full story. The accident that killed my family and the stupid thing I did last night. No more secrets. Follow me." I'm choosing the place. I mostly trust him, but until I know everything, I don't want to be completely alone with him again. We walk in silence into Central Park, passing early risers as we do. There are enough cyclists and joggers around that I feel comfortable, especially since Rufus is keeping his distance by staying on the grass, where a young golden retriever is chasing its owner around. The dog reminds me of the Countdowner story I was following when I received my alert, though I'm sure this dog and that one aren't one and the same. I maintain the silence at first because I wanted us to settle in before Rufus explains himself, but the deeper we go into the park, the quieter I get because of pure wonder, especially as we stumble onto a bronze sculpture of characters from Alice in Wonderland. Dark green leaves crush under my feet as I approach Alice and the White Rabbit and the Mad Hatter. "How long has this been here?" I'm embarrassed to ask. I'm sure it's not new.
"I don't know. Probably forever," Rufus says. "You never seen it?"
"No." I look up at Alice, who's sitting on a gigantic mushroom.
"Wow. You're like a tourist in your own city," Rufus says.
"Except tourists know more about my own city than I do," I say. This is a completely unexpected find. Dad and I prefer Althea Park, but we've spent a lot of time in Central Park, too. He loves Shakespeare in the park. Plays aren't really my thing, but I went with him to one, and it was fun for me because the theater reminded me of Colosseums and my favorite fantasy novels and gladiator matches in Rome from movies. I wish I'd discovered this piece of wonderland as a kid so I could have climbed on top of the mushrooms with Alice and imagined adventures of my own.
You found it today, Rufus says. That's a win.
You're right. I'm still stunned this has been here all along, because when you think of parks, you think of trees and fountains and ponds and playgrounds. It's sort of beautiful how a park can surprise me, and it gives me hope that I can surprise the world too. But not all surprises are welcome. I sit down on the mushroom beside the White Rabbit. Rufus sits next to the Mad Hatter. His silence is an awkward one, like those times in history class when we reviewed monumental events from the BDC days. My teacher, Mr. Poland, would tell us how good we got it for having death cast services. He'd assign us reports where we reimagined periods of significant deaths, the plague, the world wars, 9/11, etc., and how people would have behaved had death cast been around to deliver the warning. The assignments, quite honestly, made me feel guilty for growing up in a time with a life-changing advancement, sort of like how we have medicine to cure common diseases that killed others in the past. You didn't murder anyone, right? I finally ask. There's only one answer here that will get me to stay. The other will get me to call the police so he can be detained before killing anyone else.
Of course not.
I've set the bar so high it should be easy for him to stay under. Then what?
I jumped someone, Rufus says.
He's staring straight ahead at his bike, parked by the pathway.
Amy's new boyfriend. He was mouthing off about me, and I was pissed because it felt like my life was ending in a lot of ways. I felt unwanted, frustrated, lost, and I needed to take it out on someone. But that's not me. It was a glitch.
I believe him. He's not monstrous. Monsters don't come to your home to help you live. They trap you in your bed and eat you alive.
People make mistakes, I say. And my friends are the ones being punished, Rufus says. Their last memory of me will be running out the back door from my own funeral because the cops were coming for me. I left them behind. I've spent the past 4 months feeling abandoned by my family dying, and in a split second I did the same damn thing to my new family.
You don't have to tell me more about the accident if you don't want, I say. He feels guilty enough as it is, and just like I would never push a homeless person into sharing their story so I can determine whether or not they deserve my charity, I don't need Rufus to jump through any more hoops to keep my trust.
I don't want to talk about it, Rufus says, but I have to.
Rufus, 7:53 a.m. I'm lucky to have a last friend, especially when my boy's locked up and my ex-girlfriend on block. I get to talk about my family and keep them alive. The sky is getting cloudy and some strong breezes come our way. But no drops of rain yet. My parents woke up to the death cast alert on May 10th. I'm gutted already. Olivia and I were playing cards when we heard the phone ring, so we rushed to their bedroom. Mom was on the phone and keeping it together while Dad was across the room, cursing them out in Spanish and crying. First time I ever saw him cry. That was brutal. It's not like he was mad macho, but I always felt like crying was some little bitch move, which is freaking stupid. Then the death cast herald asked to speak with my pops, and Mom lost it. It was that this must be a nightmare shit. Nothing scarier than watching your parents freaking out. I was panicking, but I knew I would have Olivia. I wasn't supposed to be alone. Then Deathcast asked to speak with Olivia, and my pops hung up the phone and threw it across the room. I guess throwing phones is in our genes. Mateo is about to ask something, but stops. Say it. Never mind, Mateo says. It's not important. Well, I was wondering if you were nervous about being endlisted that day and not knowing. Did you check the online database? I nod. Deathcast.com is helpful that way. Typing my social security number and not finding my name in the database that evening was a weird sort of relief. It didn't seem right how my family was dying without me. Shit. I make it sound like I was getting left behind from a family vacation. But their end day was spent with me already missing them. And Olivia could barely look at me. I get it. It wasn't my fault I got to keep living, and it wasn't her fault she was dying. Were you too close? Mad close. She was a year older. My parents were saving up money so Olivia and I could attend Antioch University in California this fall. She had a partial scholarship, but hung back here at the community college so we wouldn't be separated until I could go with her. My breaths are tight, like when I was laying into Peck earlier. My parents tried convincing Olivia to take off to Los Angeles without me, and not settle at a school in a city she was hating on. But she refused. Every morning, afternoon, evening, I always think she'd still be alive if she'd listened to our parents. She just wanted to reboot our lives together. Olivia is the first person I came out to. Oh. I don't know if he's playing it off like he doesn't know this from my last friend profile, or if he's impacted by this piece of history between me and my sister, or if he overlooked this on my profile, and is some ass who cares about who other people kiss. I hope not. We're friends now, hands down. It's not forced. I met this kid a few hours ago because some creative designer somewhere developed an app to forge connections. I'd hate to disconnect. Oh, what? Nothing. Honestly. Can I ask you something? Let's get this over with. Did you ever come out to your parents? Mateo asks. Avoiding a question with another question. Classic. On our last day together, yeah. I couldn't put it off any longer. My parents had never hugged me like they did on their end day. I'm really proud I spoke up to get that moment out of them. My mom got really sad because she'd never get a chance to meet her future daughter or son-in-law. I was still a little uncomfortable, so I just laughed and asked Olivia if there was anything she wanted us all to do, hoping she'd hate me a little less. My parents wanted to ditch me. They were just looking out for you, right? Yeah, but I wanted every possible minute with them, even if it meant being left with the memory of watching them all die in front of me, I say. I didn't know any better. That idiocy died, too. Then what happened? Mateo asks. You don't have to have the details, I say. You might be better off without them. If you have to carry this around, I will too. You asked for it. I tell him everything. How Olivia wanted to go up one last time to this cabin near Albany, where we always went for her birthday. The roads were slippery on our way upstate, and our car flew into the Hudson River. I sat shotgun because I thought it bettered our chances of surviving a head-on car crash if both of my parents weren't in the front. It didn't matter. Same song, different verse, I tell Mateo, before going on about the screeching tires, the way we busted through the road safety rail and tumbled into the river. I sometimes forget their voices, I say. It's only been 4 months, but that's a fact. They blend with the voices of people around me, but I could recognize their screams anywhere. I'm getting goosebumps up my arms thinking about it. You don't have to go on, Rufus. I'm sorry, I shouldn't have encouraged you to keep talking about it. Mateo knows how this ends, but there's more to it. I stop because he has the basics, and I'm crying a little. I need to keep my shit together so he doesn't freak out. He places a hand on my shoulder and pats my back, and it reminds me of all the other seniors who tried comforting me over texts and Facebook, but didn't know what to say or do because they'd never lost someone the way I had. "You're okay," he adds. "Let's talk about something else, like..." Mateo scans the area around us. "Birds, and beat-up buildings, and..." I straighten up. That was pretty much it anyway. I ended up with Malcolm, Tego, and Amy. We became the Plutos, and that was exactly the kind of company I needed. We were all lost, and okay with not being found for a while. I dry my eyes with my fist and shift toward Mateo. "And now you're stuck with me until the end. Don't run away again, or you might get kidnapped and find yourself the inspiration for some shitty thriller movie." "I'm not going anywhere," Mateo says. He has a kind smile. "What's next? Game for whatever? Should we go make a moment?" I thought we were already making moments. But why not?
Mateo, 8:32 a.m. On the way to the Make a Moment station, Rufus stops in front of a sporting goods store. In the window, there are posters of a man cycling, a woman in ski gear, and a man and woman running side by side, with celebrity smiles and zero sweat. Rufus points at the woman in ski gear. "I always sent Olivia photos of people skiing. We went skiing every year, up at Wyndham. You're gonna think we were stupid for always going back. My pops broke his nose on the first trip by smashing it against a rock. We were really shocked he didn't die, even though Death Cast hadn't called. My mom sprained her ankle on the next trip. 2 years ago, I got a concussion after skiing downhill. I suck at braking and almost ran down some kid, so I switched left at the last second and slammed into a tree like some fucking cartoon character." "You're right," I say. "I have no idea why you kept going back." Olivia put her foot down after I was admitted to the hospital. But we continued driving up to Wyndham whenever we could because we loved the mountains, the snow, and playing games by our fireplace in the cabin. Rufus keeps it moving. "I'm hoping this spot is as safe and fun as that was." A few minutes later, we reach the Make a Moment station. Rufus stops and takes a picture of the entrance and its blue banner hanging above the door. "No Risk Thrills." He uploads it to Instagram in full color. "Look." He hands me his phone. It's open to the comments on his previous picture. "People are asking why I'm awake so early." There are a couple comments from Amy, begging him to pick up his phone. "What happened with Amy?" He shakes his head. "I'm done with her. Her boy is the reason Malcolm and Tego are in jail for something I did, and she's still dating him. She's not loyal." "It's not because of any feelings you have for her?" "No," Rufus says. He chains his bike to a parking meter. It doesn't matter if he's telling the truth or not. I drop it, and we head inside. I didn't expect this place to look like a travel agency. The wall behind the counter is half sunset orange, half midnight blue, and there are framed photos of people doing different activities, like rock climbing and surfing. It's easy on the eyes, I guess. Behind the counter is a young black woman in her 20s writing in a notebook that she puts away once she sees us. She's in a yellow polo shirt, and her name tag reads Deirdre. I've seen this name before, maybe in a fantasy novel. "Welcome to Make a Moment," Deirdre says, not too cheery, not too distant, the right amount of solemn. She doesn't even ask us if we're Deckers. She slides a binder toward us. There's currently a half-hour wait for the hot air balloon rides and swimming with sharks. Who the hell? Rufus turns to me, then back to Deirdre. Is swimming with sharks something people really feel like they're missing out on? It's a popular attraction, Deirdre says. Wouldn't you swim with sharks if you knew they couldn't bite you? Rufus sucks his teeth. I don't mess with big bodies of water like that. Deirdre nods as if she understands all of Rufus's history. No prob. I'm here if you have any questions. Rufus and I take a seat and flip through the binder. In addition to hot air balloon rides and swimming with sharks, the station offers skydiving, race car driving, a parkour course, zip lining, horseback riding, base jumping, whitewater rafting, hang gliding, ice, rock climbing, downhill mountain biking, windsurfing, and tons more. I wonder if this business will ever expand to fictional thrills, like running away from dragons, fighting a cyclops, and magic carpet rides. We won't be around to know. I shake it off. You want to try mountain biking? I ask. He loves biking, and there's no water involved. Nah, I want to do something new. How do you feel about skydiving? Dangerous, I say. But tell my story if this goes south. I wouldn't be surprised if I managed to die in a place that promises risk-free thrills. You got it. Deirdre gives us a 6-page long waiver, which isn't uncommon for businesses serving Deckers. But it's also definitely not uncommon that we skim the form, because it's not as if we're going to be around to sue them if something goes wrong. There are so many freak accidents that can happen at any point. Every new minute we're alive is a miracle. Rufus's signature is messy. I can make out only the first two letters before the remaining letters get lost in curves that look like a sales chart for a business that is rising and failing regularly. Okay, I've signed away my right to bitch if I die. Deirdre doesn't laugh. We pay $240 each, the kind of price you can get away with charging people whose savings accounts would go to waste otherwise. Follow me. The long hallway reminds me of the storage center where Dad worked, except inside the lockers there weren't happy screams and laughter, at least none that I ever heard of. Kidding. These rooms are like karaoke rooms, except some are twice, even three times as big. I peek in each window as we go down the hall, zigzagging like a pinball, finding Deckers with goggles in every room. Some are sitting inside race cars that are shaking, but not speeding down the racetracks. One Decker is rock climbing, while an employee in the room texts away. A couple are kissing in a hot air balloon that is hovering 6 feet, but not in the sky. A crying man without goggles is holding the back of a laughing girl on top of a horse, and I can't tell which one of them is the Decker, or if it's both, but it makes me so sad that I stop looking into the rooms. Our room isn't very large, but there are huge vents, safety mats leaning against the wall, and an instructor who's dressed like an aviator, with her curly brown hair pulled back in a ponytail. We dress up in matching gear and harnesses, the three of us looking like X-Men cosplayers, and Rufus asks the young woman, Madeline, to take a photo of us. I don't know if I should wrap my arm around him, so I follow his lead, placing my hands on my waist. "Is this good?" Madeline asks, holding the phone out to us. We look like we mean serious business, like we refuse to die until we save the world from all its ugliness. "Dope," Rufus says.
"I can take more photos while you're diving."
"That'd be cool." Madeline breaks it down for us on how this works. We'll put on the goggles, the virtual experience will begin, and the room itself will play its own role in making this feel as real as possible. Madeline locks our harnesses to suspending hooks, and we climb a ladder up to a plank that looks like a diving board, except we're only about 6 feet above the floor.
"When you're ready, press the button on your goggles and jump," Madeline says, dragging the mats under us. "You'll be fine."
She turns on the high-powered vents, and the room becomes loud with wind.
"Ready?"
Rufus mouths to me, dropping his goggles over his eyes. I do the same with my goggles and nod. I click the green button by the lens. The virtual reality kicks in. We're inside a plane with an open door, and a three-dimensional man is giving me the thumbs up to jump into the open blue sky. I'm scared to jump, not out of the plane, but into the actual open space before me. My harness might break, even though I feel 100% secure. Rufus shouts for a few seconds, descending a couple feet away from me, and goes quiet. I lift my goggles away from my eyes, hoping I don't find Rufus on the floor with a twisted neck, but he's hovering in the air, being blown side to side by wind from the vents. I shouldn't be seeing Rufus like this, but I had to know he was okay, even if it ruins the experience a little bit. I still want that same exhilaration Rufus experienced, so I put the goggles back on, count down from three, and jump. I'm weightless as I hug my arms to my chest, like I'm speeding down a tunnel slide instead of free-falling through cloud after cloud, which I suppose I'm not actually doing either. I stretch my arms out, trying to touch the wisps at the edge of multiple clouds, as if I can actually grab one and roll it around in my hands like a snowball. A couple minutes later, the magic wears off. I see the green field we're approaching, and I know I should be relieved I'm almost there, I'm almost safe again, but there was never any true danger in the first place. It's not exciting. It's too safe. It's exactly what I signed up for. Virtual Mateo lands right as I do, my feet digging into the mat. I force a smile for Rufus, who smiles back at me. We thank Madeline for her help, take off the aviator gear, and let ourselves out.
"That was fun, right?" I say.
"We should have waited to swim with sharks," Rufus says as we pass Deirdre and leave.
"Thank you, Deirdre," I say.
"Congratulations on making a moment," Deirdre says, waving. It's odd to be praised for living, but I guess she can't exactly encourage us to come again. I nod at her and follow Rufus out.
"I thought you had fun. You cheered."
He's removing the chain from the bike no one stole, unfortunately.
"For the main jump, yeah. It got whack after that."
"Did you actually like that?"
"No judgment except yes judgment."
"I felt the same as you."
"It was your idea," Rufus says, walking his bike down the block. "You don't get any more ideas today."
"Sorry."
"I'm kidding, dude. It was interesting, but low casualties are the one thing this place has going for it, and that sort of risk-free fun isn't really fun at all. We should have read reviews before dropping bank on it."
"There aren't that many reviews online," I say.
"When your service is exclusive for deckers, not many reviews are to be expected. I mean, I can't imagine any decker who would spend precious time praising or bad-mouthing the Foundation."
"And I really am sorry. Not because we wasted money, but because we wasted time."
Rufus stops and pulls out his phone.
"It wasn't a waste of time."
He shows me the photo of us in our gear and uploads it to Instagram. He tags it #lastfriend.
"I might get 10 likes out of this."
Lydia Vargas, 9:14 a.m. Deathcast did not call Lydia Vargas because she isn't dying today. But if she were, she would have told all her loved ones, unlike her best friend, who didn't come out and tell her he's dying. Lydia figured it out. The clues were laid out for her to backtrack and piece everything together. Mateo coming over super early. The kind but out-of-the-blue words he'd said about her being an awesome mother. The envelope with $400 on her kitchen counter. Blocking her number, which she taught him how to do. In the first few minutes after Mateo pulled his disappearing act, Lydia freaked out, called her abuelita, and begged her to come home from the pharmacy where she works. Instead of fielding all of abuelita's questions, she took her phone and called Mateo, but he still didn't respond. She's praying it's because he has abuelita's number stored in his contacts list, and not because he's gone. She's not thinking that way. Mateo won't live a long life, which is bullshit, because he's the greatest soul in this universe. But he'll live a long day. He can die at 11:59 p.m., but not a minute before. Penny is crying, and Abuelita can't figure out what's wrong. Lydia knows all of Penny's cries and how to calm her down. If Penny has a fever, Lydia sits Penny in her lap, singing into her ear. If Penny falls, Lydia scoops her up and hands her a toy with blinking lights, or one that jingles. Some toys do both, unfortunately. If Penny is hungry or needs a new diaper, the next steps are easy. Penny misses her Uncle Mateo. But Lydia can't FaceTime Mateo to say hi over and over because, again, he blocked her number. Lydia logs on to Facebook. She used to use this account to keep up with friends from high school, but now she uploads photos of Penny for Christian's family without having to text his parents, grandparents, aunts, and uncles, or that one cousin who's always asking for dating advice. Lydia visits Mateo's page, which is a wasteland of 19 mutual friends, two gorgeous pictures of sunrises in Brooklyn from a Good Morning New York fan page, an article about some instrument NASA created that allows you to hear what outer space sounds like, and a status from months ago that didn't receive nearly enough love about being accepted to his online college of choice. Mateo has never been good about sharing his own stuff, obviously, but you can always count on him to comment on your photo or show love to your status. If it matters to you, it matters to him. Lydia hates that Mateo is out there by himself. This isn't the early 2000s, when people were dying without warning. DeathCast is here to prepare Deckers and their loved ones, not for the Decker to turn their back on their loved ones. She wishes Mateo had let her into his life, every last minute of it. She goes through Mateo's photos, starting from the most recent, Mateo and Penny, napping on the same couch Lydia is sitting on now. Mateo carrying Penny through the reptile room at the zoo, where they were both scared of snakes escaping. Mateo and his dad in Lydia's kitchen, where his dad was teaching them how to make pegao. Mateo hanging streamers for Penny's first birthday party. Mateo, Lydia, and Penny smiling in the back seat of Abuelita's car. Mateo in his graduation cap and gown, hugging Lydia, who brought him flowers and balloons. Lydia clicks out of the photos. Memory lane is too painful when she knows he's still out there, alive. She stares at his profile picture, a photo she took of him in his bedroom, where he was looking out the window, waiting for the mailman to deliver his Xbox Infinity. This time tomorrow, Lydia will put up a status about her best friend passing. People will reach out to her and offer their condolences, much like they did when Christian passed. And after everyone remembers Mateo, whether as the boy in their homeroom or at their lunch table, they'll rush over to his page and leave comments like a digital memorial. How they hope he rests in peace. How he was too young to go. How they wish they'd taken the time to talk to him while he was alive. Lydia will never know how Mateo is spending his end day, but she hopes her best friend finds whatever he's looking for.
Rufus.
9:41 a.m. We stumble across 7 abandoned payphones in some ditch, underneath the highway leading north toward the Queensboro Bridge. We gotta go in there. Mateo is about to protest, but I hold up my finger, shutting that down real fast. I drop my bike on the ground, and we crawl through an opening in the chain-link fence. There are rusty pipes, stuffed garbage bags that smell like old food and shit, and trails of blackened gum snaking around the payphones. There's graffiti of a Pepsi bottle beating the crap out of a Coca-Cola bottle. I take a picture, upload it to Instagram, and tag Malcolm so he knows he was with me on my end day. "It's like a graveyard," Mateo says. He picks up a pair of sneakers. "If you find any toes in there, we're jetting," I say. Mateo inspects the insides of the sneakers. "No toes or other body parts?" He drops the sneakers. "Last year I bumped into this guy with a bloody nose and no sneakers." "Homeless dude?" "Nope. He was our age. He got beat up and robbed, so I gave him my sneakers." "Of course you did," I say. "They don't make them like you." "Oh, I wasn't looking for a compliment. Sorry. I'm curious what he's up to now. Doubt I'd recognize him since he had so much blood on his face." Mateo shakes his head, like it'll make the memory go away. I crouch over one payphone, and in blue Sharpie there's a message by where the receiver used to be. "I miss you, Lena. Call me back." Pretty damn hard for Lena to call you back, person without an actual phone. "This is a crazy find," I say, mad lit as I move on to the next payphone. I feel like Indiana Jones right now. Mateo smiles my way. "What?" "I watched those movies obsessively as a kid," Mateo says. "Forgot about it until now." He tells me stories about how his dad would hide treasure around the apartment, how the treasure was always a jar of quarters they used for laundry. Mateo would wear his cowboy hat from his Woody costume and use a shoelace as a lasso. Whenever he got close to finding the jar, his dad would put on this Mexican mask a neighbor bought him and would throw Mateo onto the couch for an epic fight. "That's awesome. Your pop sounds cool." "I got lucky," Mateo says. "Anyway, I hijacked your moment. Sorry." "Nah, you're fine. It's not some huge, big, worldly moment. I'm not about to go off on how removing payphones from street corners is the start of universal disconnection or some nonsense like that. I think this is just really dope." I snap some photos with my phone. "It is crazy, though, right? Payphones are going to stop being a thing. I don't even know anyone's phone number." "I only know Dad's and Lydia's," Mateo says. "If I was locked up behind bars, I would have been extra screwed. Knowing someone's number isn't going to matter anyway. You'll no longer be a quarter away from calling someone." I hold up my phone. "I'm not even using a real camera. Cameras that use film are going extinct too. Watch. Post offices and handwritten letters are next," Mateo says. "Movie rental stores and DVD players," I say. "Landlines and answering machines," he says. "Newspapers," I say. "Clocks and wristwatches. I'm sure someone's working on a product for us to automatically know the time. Physical books and libraries? Not anytime soon, but eventually, right?" Mateo is quiet, probably thinking about those Scorpius Hawthorne books he mentioned in his profile. "Can't forget about all the endangered animals." "I definitely forgot about them." "You're right. You're totally right. It's all going away. Everyone and everything is dying. Humans suck, man. We think we're so damn indestructible and infinite because we can think and take care of ourselves. Unlike payphones or books." But I bet the dinosaurs thought they'd rule forever, too. We never act, Mateo says. Only react once we realize the clock is ticking. He gestures to himself. Exhibit A. Guess that marks us next on the list, I say. Before the newspapers and clocks and wristwatches and libraries. I lead us out through the fence and turn around. But you do know no one actually uses landlines anymore, right?
Tego Hayes, 9:48 a.m. Deathcast did not call Tego Hayes because he isn't dying today, but he'll never forget what it was like seeing his best friend receive the alert. The look on Rufus's face will haunt Tego far longer than any of the gore he's seen in his favorite slasher films. Tego and Malcolm are still at the police station, sharing a holding cell that is twice the size of their bedroom. I thought for sure it was going to smell like piss here, Tego says. He's sitting on the floor because the bench is too shaky, creaking every time he shifts. Just vomit, Malcolm says, biting his nails. Tego plans on throwing these jeans out when he gets home. He removes his glasses, letting Malcolm and the desk officer blur. He's been known to do this every now and again, so everyone knows when he wants a time out from whatever is happening around him. The only time it ever pissed Malcolm off was when Tego did this during a game of Cards Against Humanity. Tego never admitted it was because the card he'd drawn from the deck was making fun of suicide, which made him think about the man who'd abandoned him. Thinking about if Rufus is alive and well makes Tego's neck ache. Tego suppresses his tic often because his neck jerking around every other minute is not only uncomfortable, but it also makes him look unapproachable and wild. Rufus once asked him what that urge feels like, so Tego got Rufus, Malcolm, and Amy to hold their breath and not blink for as long as they could. Tego didn't have to do the exercise with the Plutos to know the relief they were in for once they breathed out and blinked. His tic was as natural to him as breathing and blinking, but as his neck pulls him in directions, Tego feels little cracks, and he always imagines his bones crumbling with every turn. He puts his glasses back on. What would you do if you got the call? Malcolm grunts. Probably same thing as Ruth, except I wouldn't invite my ex-girlfriend, whose boyfriend I just jumped, to my funeral. That's no doubt where he went wrong, Tego says. What about you? Malcolm asks. Same. Do you? Malcolm stops. It's not like when Malcolm was helping Tego defeat writer's block, as he was working on Substitute Doctor and was shy about his pitch about the demon doctor wearing a stethoscope that could read his patients' minds. That was a great idea. This is something sure to piss him off. I wouldn't look for my mom or find out how my dad died, Tego says. Why not? If I knew more about the asshole who burned my home down, I'd get into my first fight, Malcolm says. I only care about the people who want to be in my life, like Rufus. Remember how he was nervous about coming out to us because he didn't want to stop sharing a room with us since we had so much fun? That's someone who wants to be in my life, and I want to be there for his, however much of it is left. Tego takes off his glasses and lets his neck run wild. Kendrick O'Connell, 10:03 a.m. Deathcast did not call Kendrick O'Connell because he isn't dying today. He may not be losing his life, but he's just lost his job at the sandwich shop. Kendrick keeps his apron, not giving a shit. He leaves the shop, lighting a cigarette. Kendrick has never been lucky. Even when he struck gold last year, when his parents finally divorced, it wasn't long before his luck ran dry. His mother and father were as good a fit for each other as an adult's foot in a child's shoe. Even at 9 years old, Kendrick recognized this. Kendrick didn't know much back then, but he was pretty sure love didn't mean that your father slept on the couch and that your mother didn't care when her husband was caught cheating on her with younger girls in Atlantic City. Kendrick has a problem with minding his own damn business and could possibly be happier if he were a little more ignorant. The first child support check came just in time, since Kendrick needed new sneakers. The front soles of his old pair had split, and his classmates made fun of him relentlessly because his shoes talked every time he walked. Open, close, open, close. Kendrick begged his mother for the latest Jordans, and she spent $300 on them because Kendrick needed a victory. At least that's what she told his paternal grandfather, who is a terrible man, but that's not a story of any importance here. Kendrick felt 10 feet tall in his new sneakers, until 4 6-foot-tall kids jumped him and stole them off his feet. His nose was bleeding, and walking home in his socks was painful, all resolved by this boy in glasses who gave Kendrick a packet of tissues he'd had in his backpack and the sneakers off his feet in exchange for nothing. Kendrick never saw him again, never got his name, but he didn't care about that. Never getting his ass kicked again was the only thing that mattered. That's when Damian Rivas, once his classmate, now a proud dropout, made Kendrick strong. It took Kendrick one weekend with Damian to learn how to break the wrist of anyone who swung at him. Damian sent him out on the street, unleashing him like a fierce pit bull onto other unsuspecting high schoolers. Kendrick would walk up on someone, clock them, and lay them out in one hit. Kendrick became a knockout king, and that's who he is today. A knockout king without a job. A knockout king with no one to hit since his gang disbanded after their third, Peck, got a girlfriend and tried to live his life right. A knockout king in a kingdom of people who keep taunting him with their purposes in life, straight begging to get their jaws dislocated.
Mateo, 10:12 a.m. I know I'm not supposed to have any more ideas.
Here we go, Rufus says.
He's riding his bike alongside me. He wanted me to get on that death trap with him. I didn't do it before, and I'm not doing it now. But I couldn't let my paranoia keep him from riding himself.
What are you thinking?
I want to go to the cemetery and visit my mom. I only know her through my dad's stories, and I'd like to spend some time with her, I say. That phone booth graveyard did a number on me, I guess. My dad normally visited my mom alone because I was too nervous to make the trip. Unless there's something else you want to do.
You really want to go to a cemetery on the day you're going to die?
Yeah.
I'm game. What cemetery?
The Evergreen Cemetery in Brooklyn. It's close to the neighborhood where my mom grew up. We're going to take the A train from Columbus Circle Station to Broadway Junction. We pass a drugstore, and Rufus wants to run in.
What do you need? I ask.
Water?
Just come on, Rufus says.
He wheels his bike down the aisles and stops when he finds the bargain toys. There are water blasters, modeling clay, action figures, handballs, scratch-and-sniff erasers, and Legos. Rufus picks up a set of Legos.
Here we go.
I'm confused.
Oh. Gear up, architect.
Rufus heads to the front counter.
You're gonna show me what you got.
I smile at this little miracle, one I doubt I would have thought to grant myself. I pull out my wallet and he flicks it.
Nah, this is on me. I'm paying you back for the Instagram idea.
He buys the Legos and we head out. He puts the plastic bag in his backpack and walks beside me.
He tells me about how he always wanted a pet, but not like a dog or cat, because his mother was deathly allergic, but instead something badass, like a snake, or fun, like a bunny. As long as both Snake and Bunny never had to be roommates, I would have been cool with it. We reached the Columbus Circle subway stop. He carries his bike down the stairs, and then we swipe our way in, catching the A train right before it departs. "Good timing," I say. "Could have been here sooner if we rode the bike," Rufus jokes. Or I think he's joking. "Could have been at the cemetery sooner if a hearse carried us." Like the train we took in the middle of the night, this one is also pretty empty. Maybe a dozen people. We sit with our backs to a poster for the World Travel Arena. "What were some of the places you wanted to travel to?" I ask. "Tons of places. I wanted to do cool stuff, like surfing in Morocco, hang gliding in Rio de Janeiro, and maybe swimming with dolphins in Mexico. See? Dolphins, not sharks," Rufus says. If we were living past today, I get the sense he'd be mocking the Deckers swimming with sharks for a long time. "But I also wanted to take photos of random sites around the world that aren't getting enough credit because they don't have cool history like the Leaning Tower of Pisa or the Colosseum, but are still awesome." "I really like that. What do you think is..." The train's lights flicker and everything shuts off, even the hum of the fans. We're underground, and we're in total darkness. An announcement on the overhead tells us we're experiencing a brief delay, and the system should be up and running again shortly. A little boy is crying as a man curses about another train delay. But this feels really wrong. Rufus and I have bigger things to worry about than getting somewhere late. I didn't observe any suspicious characters on the train, but we're stuck now. Someone could stab us, and no one would know until the lights flash back on. I scooch toward Rufus, my leg against him, and I shelter him with my body because maybe I can buy him time. Enough time to see the Plutos if they manage to get released today. Maybe I can even shield him from death. Maybe I can go out as a hero. Maybe Rufus will be the exception to the death cast is always right record. There's something glowing beside me, like a flashlight. It's the light from Rufus's phone. I'm breathing really hard, and my heart is pounding, and I don't feel better, not even when Rufus massages my shoulder. "Yo, we're totally cool. This happens all the time." "No, it doesn't," I say. "The delays do, but the lights turning off isn't common." "You're right, it doesn't." He reaches into his backpack and pulls out the Legos, pouring some of them into my lap. "Here. Build something now, Mateo." I don't know if he also believes we're about to die and wants me to create something before I do, but I follow his lead. My heart is still pounding pretty badly, but I stop shaking when I reach for the first brick. I have no clue what I'm building, but I allow my hands to keep aimlessly laying down the foundation with the bigger bricks because there's a literal spotlight on me in an otherwise completely dark train car. "Anywhere you wanted to travel to?" Rufus asks. I'm suffocated by the darkness and this question. I wish I was brave enough to have traveled. Now that I don't have time to go anywhere, I want to go everywhere. I want to get lost in the deserts of Saudi Arabia. Find myself running from the bats under the Congress Avenue Bridge in Austin, Texas. Stay overnight on Hashima Island, this abandoned coal mining facility in Japan, sometimes known as Ghost Island. Travel the Death Railway in Thailand. Because even with a name like that, there's a chance I can survive the sheer cliffs and rickety wooden bridges. And everywhere else. I want to climb every last mountain, row down every last river, explore every last cave, cross every last bridge, run across every last beach, visit every last town, city, country, everywhere. I should have done more than watch documentaries and video blogs about these places. I'd want to go anywhere that would give me a rush, I answer. Hang gliding in Rio sounds incredible. Halfway through my construction, I realize what I'm building. A sanctuary. It reminds me of home, the place where I hid from exhilaration. But I recognize the other side of the coin, too, and know my home kept me alive for as long as it did. Not only alive, but happy, too. Home isn't to blame. When I finally finish, in the middle of a conversation with Rufus about how his parents almost named him Cain after his mother's favorite wrestler, my eyes close and my head drops. I snap back awake. Sorry, you're not boring me. I like talking to you. I'm really tired. Exhausted. But I know I shouldn't sleep because I don't have time for naps. This day is really sucking everything out of me, though. Close your eyes for a bit, Rufus says. We're not moving yet, and you might as well get some rest. I'll wake you up when we get to the cemetery. Promise. You should sleep, I say. I'm not tired. That's a lie, but I know he's going to be stubborn about this. Okay. I rest my head back while holding the toy sanctuary in my lap. The light is no longer on me. I can still feel Rufus's eyes on me, though it's probably in my head. At first it feels weird, but then nice, even if I'm wrong, because it feels like I have a personal guardian looking out for my time. My last friend is here for the long run.
Rufus, 10:39 a.m. I gotta take a photo of Mateo sleeping. That sounds creepy, no shit. But I gotta immortalize this dreamy look on his face. That doesn't sound any less creepy. Shit. It's the moments, too, I want. How often do you find yourself on a train that's having a blackout with an 18-year-old kid and his Lego house as he's on his way to the cemetery to visit his mother's headstone? Exactly. That's Instagram worthy. I stand to get a wider shot. I aim in the darkness and take his picture, the flash blinding me. A moment later, no joke, the train's lights and fans come back and we continue moving. I'm a wizard, I mutter. No shit. I discover I have superpowers on my end day. I wish someone got that on camera. I could have gone viral. The picture is dope. I'll upload it when I have service. It's good I got the photo of Mateo sleeping when I did. Yeah, yeah, creepy. We established that. Because his face is shifting. His left eye twitching. He looks uneasy, and he's breathing harder, shaking. Holy shit, maybe he's epileptic. I don't know. He never told me anything like that. I should have asked. I'm about to call out for someone on the train who might know what to do if he's having a seizure, when Mateo mutters, "No," and repeats it over and over. Mateo is having a nightmare. I sit beside him and grab his arm to save him.
Mateo, 10:42 a.m. Rufus shakes me awake. I'm no longer on the mountain. I'm back on the train. The lights are on and we're moving. I take a deep breath as I turn to the window, as if I'm actually expecting to find boulders and headless birds flying my way. Bad dream, dude? I dreamt I was skiing. That's my bad. What happened in the dream? It started with me going down one of those kiddie slopes. The bunny slope? I nod. Then it got really steep, and the hills got icier, and I dropped my ski poles. I turned around to look for them, and I saw a boulder coming for me. All of a sudden it got louder and louder, and I wanted to throw myself off to the side into this mound of snow, but I panicked. I was supposed to turn down another hill where I saw my Lego sanctuary, except it was as big as a cabin.
but my skis disappeared, and I flew straight off the mountain while headless birds circled overhead, and I kept falling and falling. Rufus grins. "It's not funny," I say. He shifts closer to me, his knee knocking into mine. "You're okay. I promise."